Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 25, Teaching the Fables. Fables are like fairy tales, something that you probably are familiar with, that you know, even if in your education, as is likely, you might never have been told a fable or a fairy tale, even if your parents didn't choose to tell you those stories when you were little. They just live around us, that they're so imprinted in Western culture in particular, though the fables even more universally, that everybody sort of knows them, or you've heard figures of speech that refer to one or another fable, and that gives you a feeling that you know that fable, even if you don't really know it. So it's very interesting. These are stories that, as I would say, along with the fairy tales, are almost inside our DNA. They're almost embedded within us, whether we've actually heard many of them or not. And it's also interesting that when I grew up in the 1950s and we bought our first television set, which was around 1954, I think, something like that. And of course, already then, a very important part of TV's presentations in those days were Saturday morning fare for children, seemed to be especially directed to boys. And a great deal of this was either animated cartoons or acting by human actors, films, and I would say that two-thirds of them or more were either directly drawn from Aesop's fables and or fairy tales, or certainly not too distantly adapted from those stories. So even though I grew up at a time when the telling of these stories was disappearing from the home and certainly from the school, it came another way. So it's very, very interesting. I mean, certainly one can rightfully so rant and rail against the onset of television and what destruction that wrought in the cultural continuity of our age and the relationship of children to literature and to the oral tradition and all of that. But I would have to acknowledge that it was actually television that, for a period of time anyway, kept alive the fairy tales. And then they started to be reinterpreted, and then, of course, we also have the movie versions in which I mention in the Grade 1 conference, which have created such stereotypes about the fairy tales. The fables, however, tend not to get terribly changed, and this is something very interesting. They're so short, they're so cogent, that it's hard to imagine improving them in any way or having to expurgate them. So they have a life of their own, and when we bring them to the children, many of whom, especially Waldorf children, have heard these stories or have heard references to them because their parents may very well have told them, and I'll share a little story about that in a moment. Nonetheless, the children are fascinated by them, and you feel something very satisfying awakens in the child, a kind of understanding, an objectification, or as T.S. Eliot called it, an objective correlative for something that they've been observing about life. It's brought in an external form, which is so much akin to the nature of the second grader. They're stories in which the animals appear almost exclusively. Very few human beings appear in fables. It's almost all animals, which is like an externalization of what the child is carrying in his or her own astral body. Again, bringing something external to the life of the child in second grade is very satisfying. But there's a danger that you have to attend to. Fairy tales already had that. Fables have it. There'll be other things as well that you're going to teach in the future that are so familiar, are so much just a part of our everyday cultural consciousness that we can tend to feel we know what they're about. You know, everybody knows what the fables are, and they're just there. And I would say the more mundane, the more ordinary, the more of a kind of a priori given something that you're about to teach is, the more you have to be aware that there may be something much deeper there, much more meaningful than you might guess, that we should not just treat the fables as the sort of lighter part of second grade, but I would say recognize that they carry equal weight in the child's approach to life and equal weight in our guidance of the children in grade two. With this in mind, I want to share some of the research that I've done over time to try to understand the nature of these fables and why they do occupy an important role in the second grade curriculum. So let's start with Aesop, who is said to be the creator of these fables. And you can assume in our time that anything that is claimed to be true that is more than about 300 years old will have a whole school of scholarship saying it's not true at all. It's completely mistaken. It's all made up. The further back in history you go, the less modern scholars tend to believe any of that is true, or, you know, that the dates are wrong, the places are wrong, the names of the people involved are wrong, and the national affiliations are wrong. Otherwise, the story may have a seed of truth in it. So Aesop is like this. It is remarkable how much attention was paid to Aesop in the ancient world. It is believed, possibly, that he is even depicted on a coin, and that was pretty much left to gods and emperors to appear in that way. He was accounted to be one of the wisest men of his time, and shortly after his purported death, though we don't know exactly when that was, any more than we exactly know his birth, or than we exactly know whether he was born in Turkey or in Africa, Ethiopia to be specific, Phrygia, Levant, whatever, it's all up for grabs now. But nonetheless, this was an individuality, a life, even if it was just a name, maybe completely a composite of many storytellers of his time. But he did not go away in the ancient world, brought again and again. His work translated so much into so many languages that we have no idea what the original language was, though it was certainly the Greeks who probably first put his stories into a regular, standardized oral tradition, and then finally into print. Very, very interesting, the effect that these stories had on the ancient world, and then because of their multifarious translations, they were among the few traditions of the ancient world that were kept alive in the Middle Ages. A great deal that we know, for example, about ancient Greece today comes to us from the Renaissance and essentially disappeared with the fall of Rome and was only then revived in the Platonic schools in the 15th century in Florence and other places. You'll learn all about that in the Grade 7 online conference, by the way. But Aesop, he just continued. Nothing could stop him. He was accepted by Christians. He was accepted by Muslims. I'm sure that there were synagogues in which his fables were told, though perhaps in a much more kosher way, we might imagine. But there he was. He appears again and again. And very importantly, what many of us know about Aesop are the morals to the stories. We all have those phrases kind of embedded in us. And it might be that our parents told us the moral and never told us the story, which they might not have known. Never trust flatterers, you know. Watch out for a wolf in sheep's clothing. You should be the tortoise rather than the hare. That sort of thing. Those morals, according to Rudolf Steiner, were not Aesop's. They were added by medieval priests who used the fables very often when they preached on Sunday. They were part of their sermons, interestingly enough. So the stories got Christianized, and for the sake of those perhaps who couldn't quite think through these very complex plots, they were told what it all meant at the end, a little bit the way, you know, critics do that for all of us in newspapers or on the internet today. And Steiner says, don't tell the morals. That really destroys the story. Leave the child free, because not every child will come to the same conclusions. So here's an example of this. A mother had heard me lecture about fables, and in which I was speaking about them as material that is just perfect for the second grader, for the 8-year-old child. She had a daughter who was 4 or 5. I think she was 4 at the time. And the little girl went up to her one day and said, "Mommy, Mommy, I love you, I love you. Give me a big hug." And just as her mother started to move to embrace the daughter ran away laughing and laughing. And then she came up to her mother later on that day and said again and again, "Mommy, Mommy, I love you so much. I love you. I want to hug you." And as she appeared to move to hug her mother forgot what had happened earlier, went to hug her, and again, the girl ran off laughing and laughing. And her mother thought, okay, you know, twice is not so good. She needs a story to help her with this. Oh, I know, the boy who cried wolf. And then she thought, but Eugene Schwartz says that's a story for second graders. Well, I'm going to tell it anyway. I can't think of anything better. So she told her daughter the story of the boy who cried wolf. Do I have to tell you that story? You know, he keeps crying wolf to get attention, and everyone runs, and no wolf is there. And then finally, when the wolf really appears and he cries out, nobody comes to his aid. So she told that story, and the child was just fascinated by it. And then she thought to herself, Eugene Schwartz says you're not supposed to tell the moral of the story. But she's so young for the story, I don't think she'll really get it. So let me see. So she said to her daughter, you know, just the kind of thing she heard me saying you never do with children. Anyway, with a young child, she did this for her daughter and said, "What do you think that story means?" And her 4-year-old daughter said, "I know." She said, "It means that if you if you keep calling the wolf enough, one day he will come." So I thought that was brilliant. Much, much better conclusion, much better moral than the one that's usually given. So probably that's what you should do with your class. Ask them what they think the meaning of that story is, and you may be astonished at the variety of meanings that live in a story. See, and that's the problem. You tell the children the moral of the story, and in a way, you've killed the story. You've deadened, you've embalmed their experience of it. There's one meaning to the story. And perhaps that's why Bob Dylan, in an interview, when he was asked what the message of one of his songs was, said, "Messages are for Western Union." The same with the fables. This is not about messages and morals, and Aesop certainly did not append them to his stories. So we'll go on in the next lecture to look a little bit more at this enigmatic, possibly semi-imaginary figure of Aesop, who nonetheless has real significance for us.